I am David Murdock. I am the lead on Ganache at Truffle. And this here is Nick Paterno.
Yep.
Blockchain engine or engineer. Couldn't fit it in the slide, so it's shortened.
I work on Ganache and Truffle teams.
Yep. So if you have Ganache questions, we are the people at Truffle to ask. Let me move this a little closer. So you all probably know who Truffle is. I don't imagine it's new to anyone. But if you don't, so Truffle is a company whose goal is to build tools to get developers from idea to dApp as comfortably as possible. So I think sums up our goal pretty well. So we have three main open source tools. So one is Truffle, which is a dev environment testing framework and asset pipeline for blockchains. Drizzle is a front-end library for dApps, and then of course Ganache, which is your one-click blockchain. So what is Ganache? So Ganache actually comes in three variants, and most people think of Ganache as the UI. What do you guys think? Who's here? Who is aware of UI and CLI and core? So who hasn't heard of one of those things? Which one?
Core.
Okay. Anyone else?
Yeah, actually, I
don't know. Okay, so core is the part of Ganache that does all of the heavy lifting. Ganache Core is a separate NPM project that CLI actually just wraps around. If you do a require Ganache Core in your project, then you will get the provider and the server that CLI give you, and you can access it through programmatic access rather than on the CLI. So this is what Ganache UI looks like. This is the main account screen that starts up. You get 10 accounts by default. You have a mnemonic. Don't put that on mainnet, please. Just assume that your computer is compromised. Don't put that on mainnet. So this is Truffle contract integration. So if you have a Truffle project, you can add that to Ganache UI, and you can actually see all of your deployed to your local testnet Ganache contracts there, how many transactions there are, et cetera. All right, pretty useful. And new, as of yesterday, we have Ganache forking. Does anyone know what Ganache forking is? Nobody.
All right.
That's fine. What about Ganache CLI and fork mode? Has anyone seen that? You do?
All right.
Okay. You come up and teach.
All right.
Well, good. So Ganache forking is a really hidden feature of Ganache. It's now in UI, and the alpha version, you guys can download it. Let me know if it breaks or not. I literally published it yesterday, so might not be too stable. But Ganache forking lets you, I'll just read it, easy mainnet testing without the cost. So what that means is inside of Ganache UI, you can now select mainnet, from Infura as a provider, or you can put your own provider in. And Ganache will then fork at a specific block number that you specify or latest. And so when you start up Ganache, you will actually get instantly, well, a couple seconds, these are mainnet block numbers right here, and the dates that they were mined, and the gas used for them, and all of the transactions right here without syncing. And additionally, when you now run your contracts against your local Ganache, it actually emulates being on mainnet. Does that cover it? Does that sound good?
Yep, so risk-free.
No cost, so you can deploy your contracts to mainnet using other contracts that are deployed on mainnet. So sorry, to Ganache UI, like it was on mainnet. So it's fully emulating
mainnet. So it's like you fork right at this lock number here, the 4 o'clock, and all the data that is on mainnet is now available to your contracts on your local machine. Pretty great feature.
Any new transactions will then go on the fork, so you're sort of risk-free access, and then if you had sort of to access some state or data that was previously on the chain, we'll just request it from your provider.
Questions for that?
So how do you get this on an account? Because do you initialize a new account and overwrite it all?
Yeah, so we actually just, so the accounts that you saw a couple slides back, so you actually, the way that works is we just lie to the state, and we just say each of these has 100 ETH. So that's just the default. And so we do the same thing with forking. As soon as we fork, the very next block number is an empty block that basically just changes the state. We just kind of force it to happen.
In addition, on that note, actually, we also allow you to sort of pretend to be any account that you want. So if you want it to be issue transactions on behalf of account that you
have. Yeah, you could be account zero if you wanted.
Right. So,
yeah.
So technically you could use mainnet accounts too.
Yeah.
If right.
You don't have the
right. So you can emulate them, yeah. So you can unlock those accounts if you wanted to in your local instance and test for those. Yep.
So you could pretend to be the DAO hacker and hack the DAO.
Yeah. excuse me. Ethereum development is kind of high risk. Actually, earlier today, we burnt some Ether trying to deploy, and it failed. We shouldn't have, but we did. Other issues are your bytecode is public, so you can't hide your source code. So, you shouldn't use obscurity by obscurity. Security by obscurity, but in a way we all kind of do in normal development. But Ethereum's a little different. All your contracts are public, so anyone can run your software. And I think you all know this, but meanwhile the hackers are private and anonymous, and there's no recourse for if your contract gets drained. You don't know who that is, and there's no jurisdiction that can come after those people. So if you mess up, you or your users lose big, zero recourse. So some key concepts we're going to go over just real quick. Gas, fallback functions, and re-entrancy. Sorry, I can't actually see that slide. To transact on Ethereum, you must pay a fee. This fee is paid in gas. Gas is paid for in Ether. Operations on Ethereum, like storing and treating data, transferring funds, math operations, looping, all that requires some amount of gas. Generally, if a transaction attempts to use more gas than it is given, the transaction fails and those state changes are persisted. So now fallback functions, these are functions that can execute operations as long as there's enough gas forwarded to it. A fallback function must be external, and it is the unnamed function in your contract. It is called when a contract's address is sent Ether, or a non-existent contract function is called. Who hasn't heard of fallback functions? I won't go through this. Just skip over that. And re-entrancy vulnerability. Does anyone know what that is already? You do? Yeah. Cool. Yeah, a couple of you. So this will be fun. I don't know, we spent like an hour trying to come up with this line. We tried to get it down to one, but we couldn't. But so the kind of most basic way I can define re-entrancy vulnerability for smart contracts is it's when a contract permits unintended re-invocation of any of its methods after calling an external contract during a single transaction. It was pretty dense. So I'll say it one more time. When a contract permits unintended re-invocation of any of its methods after calling an external contract during a single transaction. So another way of saying it, smart contract re-entrancy allows for multiple invocations of a contract method during a single transaction, usually caused by forwarding excess gas to a malicious contract's fallback function without proper re-entrancy protection. So that's there's a lot to take in there. And we're going to get into much more of this. So a re-entrant vulnerability example. Does anyone know actually where the vulnerability is in this code?
Real
sample
makes it the balance is zero after we send.
So this line right here is a re-entrancy vulnerability. And the reason for that is sender.call.value will pass all of the remaining gas that's left for this transaction into the sender. And so if sender is a contract, and with a fallback function that is payable, then this sender will be able to execute additional transactions after the fallback function is called. And so one of those transactions may be to recall withdraw. And now the problem with that is that this line will execute. I think I have all this set up here. Oh, wait. Hold on, I'm getting ahead of myself. We'll get there. Where am I?
It's good.
Too fast, too far. Right? Where's that right? No, it's good. Okay. We'll go through the disclaimer. Volume. Sorry.
Yeah, now we're designing.
It's too quiet. We'll skip it.
Yeah,
alright, so I'll just read the disclaimer. We'll skip the Jurassic Park scene. Before we get started, and I teach you guys how to do this, just remember, just because you can, doesn't mean you should. The intent of this workshop is to teach you how to protect your contracts. It is not to teach you how to exploit others' contracts. So don't steal, be legal, be nice to people.
This is for testing your own contracts and in a real world scenario.
Yeah. So don't say Truffle taught me how to steal from people. Thanks. Okay, so I was getting ahead of myself there. I really wanted to start on this. So this would be an example of an attacker's contract that they upload in order to be bad. So and this down here is the fallback function. And so we saw that in that contract earlier that it was could be re-entered. And so I'll show you how that works here. So what happens is, initially, that one of the cases in the contract is to seed it with some amount of value. And so what it's doing here is it's depositing, let's say, one ether into the victim, which is the contract we saw just couple slides ago, into that contract. So they now own that ether as their own balance in that contract. So the attacker then would call the BBAT function, which would then call withdraw. And now this would all work wonderfully, so this withdraw would then just withdraw this one value. But because of this hacker being a little bit clever, they implemented this fallback function. And what this function is going to do is after the original contract gets this amount from them, from the caller, from this contract here, it'll get their balance and it will record that and then send that amount back to the contract. And at which point the contract will then be able to go into this fallback function and call withdraw again. And so what this then does is re-enters and checks the balance. But we haven't zeroed out the balance yet in the original contract. So this balance is still the full one ether. And so this is the second time we've been here. And so the next line is going to be to call that fallback function again. And so we're back into the bad guy's contract, and what are they gonna do? They're gonna withdraw yet again. And they can do that as long as they have enough gas. So that's what this little check here is. It just checks gas to make sure that the transaction won't fail on them. So pretty crazy. Happens in the real world. So this is an example of how you would execute this sort of attack using Truffle to run your test. So the attacker would deploy their contract to mainnet and execute the attack against the target contract. So all you need to do is run Truffle test.
Code looks like this.
So this is, let's see. This is how you would deploy. So we're seeding it with the one ether here. Deploying it there and executing the attack. And that's it. That's all it would take. All right, so what we've covered so far, truffle, ganache forking, gas, fallback functions, reentrancy, the exploit, and a little bit about truffle test. Any questions so far? Someone has. No?
Good.
All right. So we've all heard of the DAO hack. And the DAO hack was a hack that was based on reentrancy. It was a reentrancy vulnerability in this function right here. So they are, in this function here, they are sending all of the remaining gas to the recipient. And that enabled the recipient to call back into this function. It was actually much more complicated than this. There was several methods that they had to go through and kind of configure in order to get this payout to be called again. But this is how they did it. Any questions on that? I'll leave it open for a second. Well, questions? Anyone have any? We're good? Did I skip a slide? No. You're good. Cool. So there's a bunch of ways to do reentrancy protection in your contracts and your methods. So one is this thing called check effects interaction pattern. And so where first you do a check, so you see that error balance is greater than zero, for instance. And then you perform the effect that an interaction will have. So this is you zero out the balance before you send it, which is what you were saying earlier. And then once you do the effect, then you finally run the interaction. Another way is using locking or mutex or open zeppelins like reentrancy guard. And this basically is, you have a Boolean value, you can call it lock or whatever you want, which would be true, false. And so when you come in here the first time, this require statement will pass. And then you would immediately lock it. So now if anything happens when you do the things, this condition will fail because lock is now true. And then when you're done, make sure that you unlock your contract. If you don't, if there's an error and this lock doesn't unlock, then you can effectively lock your contract, preventing you from interacting with it even. Okay, got ahead of myself. And this is really important. Who has heard of address send and address transfer and why those were added, or one of the reasons why? Does anyone know? So these were added because of the address.call sending all of the remaining gas by default. And so that was seen as a vulnerability in that it wasn't clear that that would enable reentrancy. And so what they did is they came up with address send and address transfer, which will automatically limit the amount of gas that's passed to 2300. Ish. It's complicated, but what that did was effectively make it so that it was too expensive to do anything in a fallback function that could possibly result in reentrancy. And so now if you use address sender or address set transfer and to send that ether, the fallback function would be stuck there. It wouldn't be able to get back out and into your contract, which sounds great. It sounds like that would fix everything. And it did, but the problem was, I went two slides again. Constantinople. Everyone knows about Constantinople, I'm guessing. It's great. So Constantinople had an EIP that actually lowered the minimum gas cost for storage from 5,000 to 200 gas.
In certain situations.
Right, ish. Again, it's complicated. So when that would happen, fallback functions could now call back in and perform re-entrancy because of Constantinople. And we only caught this a couple days before it was going to go live, which is crazy. Well, luckily we caught it. It was removed and never made it to mainnet, also ish. Because it actually is active on mainnet, which is a fun fact. And then there's Istanbul. So Istanbul's increased gas costs actually kind of do the opposite as Constantinople's decreases were doing, and that there are now functions on live contracts that will no longer work. So this is actually copy-pasted from a contract that will be fixed before Istanbul goes live. But these three parts, or specifically the total, that would actually do like two S loads or one S load. And because of increased costs in the S loads and a couple of other opcodes, this will now fail every single time. There's no way for this to pass under Istanbul. So the point being that you cannot rely on gas costs to protect against reentrancy. So just remember that. That's the only thing. Just always be aware of that. So the honeypot. Honeypot is fun. Has anyone heard of a honeypot in like InfoSec? Yeah. So honeypots in InfoSec are actually a little bit different than what we call honeypots in Ethereum. But we're gonna keep calling it a honeypot. Because that's just, we name things the way we want. So a honeypot is a way to trick the bad guy into becoming a victim. And I forgot, I wanted to time that. So there are several types of honeypots. This is you. You can go. You go for this.
Sure. There are three different sort of general types. Actually, they're really well laid out at a PDF here that you can find at this link. But in general, the sort of taxonomy of honeypots are those are three main classes. You have a class of honeypots that interact with the Ethereum virtual machine, some that happen during compilation, and some that are actually just due to misleading or missing information on a block explorer. So for example, like EVM is actually just a well-defined set of rules, and everyone should be sort of, or has access to those rules. However, given the implementation of some contracts, they could look sort of non-intuitive and therefore would be able to trick you. Some bugs actually exist in the Solidity compiler. They're actually usually very well documented, but there can be some that have not been discovered yet, or that are sort of zero-day settled. And then, for example, you have some things in blockchain explorers, for example, like there was a time where Etherscan only showed you 80 characters wide, and if you were to upload a contract that had something outside of that, you wouldn't be able to see, say, that there was a send or a transfer or something. So that's the general gist, and we'll go into some of these later.
So this next slide is fun, but you're not gonna be able to hear it. So just load the slides up. Some people came in just now. So make sure you go to these slides at shuffle.co/defcon5. So this next one slide, I'm gonna skip over, but it's fun and I spent too much time on it, so you guys should just check it out. Just tell me if you liked it. We'll go ahead and skip.
So trace buster buster. Anyway, so far we've covered truffle, ganache, ganache forking, gas, fallback functions, reentrancy, exploit, testing, and the DAO, Constantinople and Istanbul, reentrancy protection, and honeypots. Questions about any of that? Yes?
What's the difference between
send and transfer? Do you remember the difference, something about if the way it fails, right?
If I recall correctly, it's, I believe it's what is passed along as your message.sender and like sort of like the context of who's calling, or is that the call?
Yeah, I think it is just the way that it fails. There's actually a really excellent answer for it on Stack Overflow. I just can't remember which one does what. But
I'm gonna double check it.
Okay.
Yeah.
Any other questions?
Send latency of Boolean. Sorry, the transfer is send latency of Boolean flash or anything or something, and transfer directly reverse message.
Okay, so send will return a Boolean, yes it worked or no it didn't. And then transfer will
exception this time.
Okay, so like revert?
If it doesn't
work. Okay. There we go.
Sorry, I did hear the part about honeypot. So honeypot is in the contract that you deploy that you get.
Right, yeah, so a honeypot is kind of like an idea. So it's like, you can have like lots of different types of honeypots. So in InfoSec, it would be called like a mousetrap.
Okay.
So like a honeypot in InfoSec is just like a deterrent, like. Or a way to learn about your attacker. So you set up a network that looks open and see what the attacker does if they try. That way you can learn from them. So in InfoSec, mousetrap is a way of trying to convince the attacker to come into your network and give something up somehow. And that way you can catch them and win that way. So we're actually, so in Ethereum, everyone calls a honeypot or a mousetrap on a honeypot. So a honeypot is a contract that fools somebody, an attacker, into giving something up. And usually that's going to be ether. So
yeah, transfer throws and send returns false, not a failure.
All right, so workshop time. We're gonna take all of that and we're going to exploit or attempt to exploit a known honeypot on mainnet. And so, as an overview, what we'll be doing is taking the code that we see on Etherscan. So that this person that uploaded this contract, maybe it's one of you, you don't know, they uploaded their contract code to Etherscan, except it wasn't their contract code. So even though Etherscan can verify that's right by code, there's some tricks in there that make it actually behave differently than what you see in the code. And so we're going to see how, if you just wanted to exploit this because you're a bad guy and you wanted to steal the ether that is stored in the contract, it would fail. And so we're going to do that. We're going to run this, and we're going to run it locally in Ganache, and we're going to see that it fails. And then we're going to run it locally in Ganache with forking enabled off of mainnet. And the conference Wi-Fi is a little rough, but we're going to try anyway. And yeah, it'll be fun. So everyone needs to go to workshop. Once you get to this slide, make sure you're on. You download Node.js. I just put 10 there. It should work on 8. It will likely work on 12. I found a lot of Ethereum tooling doesn't work well on V12. If you want to use UIs because you're more comfortable in the UI, maybe try to download Ganache UI Alpha. I can also try to set up. I have all the versions for Mac, Windows, Linux on my laptop, and so I can give you links to try to download direct from my laptop network if we have to, or install Ganache CLI, and you make sure you use the global flag here. If anyone needs help with Node or NPM, let us know. And then you will want to clone this link, so that's where going to this website will help. You'll be able to get this link pretty easily. So clone this. If you need help with that, let us know. And then run npm install in here. And again, it's a workshop. So ask your neighbor, ask us, and we'll help you. David Clark. Not David Clark. Yeah.